This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tab, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Forgive me for running off the vine, and the one thing I have to do.
Welcome to the Watch Something Evil podcast. True honor to have Mr. Jim Atkins from G8 World be part of the podcast. From the unknown to the known, and with enough stories through it all, the band are still touring, still writing music for the fans that continue to come out night after night in all over the world. Jim agreed to take a trip down memory lane, and there's no better place than here. So, Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
what got you into music? Was it a parent? Was it a brother? You know, and was it someone that kind of showed you Maximum Rock and Roll, or someone gave you a mixtape and that was it?
Well, my dad played guitar, like, very early on. So that's probably my first exposure to music in general. And then my parents, made me take piano lessons, which is, I think, every little kid should probably take piano lessons just to kind of see if they have an aptitude for it. But, that and also, I think maybe like the early days of like MTV, mm-hmm. like seeing Quiet Riot videos, you know, like just the kind of theatrical metal, like, you know, like the, I mean, come on, that just looks badass, you know, like the...
You're like, I want to do this.
Oh yeah. So like, you know, seeing like the airplane hangar set with like, you know, beyond like the, you know, Thunderdome kind of like set up with the Scorpions playing and
yep, fire,
insane, yeah, fire, explosions, dudes with swords,
Manowar too. You probably watched Manowar, right?
Yeah. And just the whole theatrical metal thing, I think, was influential to me as a kid.
And then, I mean, from that, learning about new bands, what did it start with metal and then kind of lean to punk and then into hardcore? Then, you know, did it kind of go that route?
Yeah, it always started. Well, it was kind of like more, the metal stuff is kind of what made me gravitate toward wanting to play guitar. But at the same time, I was also like buddies with people who had like cool older brothers and sister. I'm the oldest of my siblings, and so I didn't have like an older brother to turn me on to cool stuff, but I hung out with a lot of other kids that did, and you know, that's how I found out about like people like Violent Femmes and Jesus and Mary Chain and, you know, skate rock.
Mm-hmm.
I think skateboard culture kind of took me from metal into hardcore, you know.
Yeah, I feel
or thrash anyway.
Yeah, I feel like that sort of progression has been really similar with a lot of people in this time frame. So it's just interesting that so many people kind of had that same progression. I'm sure it happens to a lot of different people, but specifically to this time frame, it's very interesting to hear that.
Yeah, and I think any guy, especially around my age, probably has like a secret like metal phase that from which most other music spawned.
Yeah.
Most other tastes spawned.
Do you remember the first time that you sang live in front of someone?
In fifth grade, I had a Violent Femmes influenced band.
That's awesome.
We didn't really perform anywhere, but we made recordings, and that was probably the first time I experimented with singing, playing, writing.
There has to be video of that. I'm just kidding.
No.
I'm just kidding.
Although me and one of the guys in the quote unquote band, we did call up a girl he wanted to ask to go with him and sing her a song, and it was successful. So I guess we did have one audience member.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny. It's really funny.
So it totally worked. So your show of one worked.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I guess from, kind of just early stuff, do you, the first record that you owned, was there any kind of special moment or, time, or do you remember going to the record store or someone handing it to you or?
I remember, I think early, my parents would let me buy like a cassette every week, which was pretty cool. Like, I remember, actually, this was kind of back in the when I started kind of showing my parents that I wanted to really to learn guitar, and instead of continuing with piano, I would go to lessons, and those days it'd be like in a different part of town, and there'd be a music store, and we'd always kind of I would buy a cassette a week, and I remember one week where I might have told the story before, but it's pretty pivotal. Like, I had in one hand I had Def Leppard's Pyromania, and in the other hand I had Nina's 99. And I think if I had gone with Nina, my life would have been much different today. It's like the defining point where the rest of my musical career was kind of determined from that choice.
Wow, I like that.
Yeah, so that's kind of, yeah. So I think maybe like my first records were cassettes, like Def Leppard, Pyromania, High and Dry, Quiet Riot, No Help, Twisted Sister, Stay Hungry, like those kinds of things. First Violent Femmes, album, Van Halen, basically stuff that like was popular and had guitar based rock.
Mm-hmm.
Not super on the heavy side yet, but guitar-based rock.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the first record for me, your band, that was Helmet. It kind of, I was like, this isn't really metal, but it's heavy, but it's not. It's kind of both.
Helmet blew my mind when that first album came out.
You remember the first show, or first kind of actual kind of show that you went to and felt like, wow, this is amazing. This is, please tell me it's Def Leppard, because then that completes the circle.
No. Well, I mean, my dad took me to, I think my mom didn't want to go out, and my dad really wanted to go see Paul Simon play. So it was like pre-Graceland. It was just him solo, I would say it was my first concert, but I mean, I think more in line with what you're asking was, probably going to see 7 Seconds play.
Nice.
I think they had just gotten back together and they were touring again. And it was we went with, I'm not sure if my parents even knew we went. It was like a scummy part of him. But, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think those kind of first shows, those kind of pivotal moments, if it's going to see those shows and feeling something, obviously now everything's coming back around again. Reunions are happening, bands are back, touring. why now? Is it, I mean, a lot of people have a lot of explanations. Me, I think they got older. They wanted to relive the kind of that time, and everyone's old enough where they can get a babysitter and go see the show. What do you feel that kind of, why now is that time? Or is it all just cyclical, and in 10 years we'll be seeing the same thing happen?
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, you have people in like you have people in my grade, you have the getting back together and doing tours and albums, and you have the older kids getting back together and doing albums and stuff. And, I don't doubt that we'll see the freshman class coming along soon and getting back together and playing shows. I think it's just, it is sort of cyclical. I think that you, I don't know, it's natural to want to celebrate work that you're proud of. People dissolve their acts, you know, their groups for whatever reason. And I think time heals a lot of that, you know, and then it was just fun, you know, I mean, for a lot of people, like, especially around, especially in the kind of scene that we were involved in, I think, that's when we were, you know, kids figuring it all out for the first time. It's kind of nostalgic, you know, period in our lives. And it is kind of nice to reexamine that and mm-hmm. be able to appreciate it, you know? I mean, I do that. I mean, I do that all the time because we've never broken up, but
yeah,
but in the times where we are working on really old material, or we're doing like we're performing like an entire like older album or something like that. It's you can definitely appreciate the moment more, you know.
Does it take you back? Like if you're doing something off Static Prevails that you haven't done in a while, you're like, holy shit. Or is it, forgot it.
we don't really play a whole lot of Static stuff anymore, but
that's what I'm saying. Like if you did, like you'd probably bring up a lot of stuff, or you'd be like, okay, what was that again? Or what was I feeling at that moment?
I think it'd be more like, why the hell did we write this and put it here? Like, what the hell were we thinking? And why were we on a major label again for this kind of a record? Like, what?
Do you guys think that a lot? Do you look back at that record and go, what were you?
Oh, we had no business being on Capitol. We had no business being on a major label with the kind of material that we were coming up with, and with our market positioning, our rabid fan base of 3,000 people who had bought various like 7 inches that we put out.
But from that, would you think that clarity would have, you know, happened out of that? I mean, I think those kind of go hand in hand. I think, I don't know. I sometimes think about it. If that didn't happen, would have you guys have had the opportunity? Or because I feel like, you know, Clarity was a pretty big budget, I assume, or at least had a lot of you know, oomph to it from label side.
Well, I think we approached making that record like we would never get a chance to make another record in an actual studio again. So we did go kind of nuts and like, you know, all right, today we're renting timpani. Yeah, I don't know what we're doing, but we're getting tubular bells, wood blocks, timpani, xylophones, you know.
Just that record seemed to, you guys brought the kitchen sink, and it definitely worked.
It seems pretty tame, though, now, you know, like in comparison. I mean, there's definitely experimentation with, like, using production as dynamic enhancers for the song's sake, you know, but it's pretty tame compared to what a lot of people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we thought was like really pushing the boundaries for us back then would have been like it was really weird that we put a tambourine on something. Like it's Static Prevails. Like,
yeah.
Whoa, that's not punk. what's that? Come on. Oh man, we really sold out now. I got a tambourine on song. Yeah. No, I mean, like, but that was like, you know, us pushing the boundaries of our
self-perception back then was tambourine.
I think you know, having sort of that progression of you guys, you know, thinking that you shouldn't have been on, you know, Capitol, we'll be doing this record. I think kind of going back to some of the early touring stuff. I mean, there's a story that goes around that I think Eric's mentioned that I wanted to kind of corroborate with you and if it's true or false. I mean, when you guys were early on, you know, punk stuff, was seeing Christy Front Drive that sort of pivotal shift where you were saying, wait a minute, or was it, you know, the Mineral guys, or what kind of, you know, what band, or was that? Just, I'd like to kind of hear your story, sort of that kind of turning point, because you guys were, you know, kind of a pretty rad punk band, first off.
Well, I think we just got exposed to a whole lot of stuff. I mean, I think when you're starting out and you're, you know, finding your niche with you know, collaborating with other people in writing music and, you know, performing and playing, I mean, we were kind of figuring that all out at the same time, you know, within ourselves or our band. And, you know, we just kind of, what we played was not dissimilar to our record collections at the time, you know, so there was a lot of Propagandhi and Face to Face and, but also like Rocket from the Crypt and Superchunk, you know, so there was like, again, it was kind of like guitar based rock, but it was kind of more on a, you know, the accessible versus challenging, you know, ratio was kind of like, you know, always in kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely faster. And it was definitely more aggressive. And I think, I don't know, just kind of over time. I mean, there was like right when I got out of high school, I mean, maybe Eric told you about this, but, you know, it was sort of like, my soon to be college roommate decided he wanted to be a record label. So poof, he was a record label. And me and two other buddies of mine decided that we would be promoters. So poof, we were promoters. And I really feel bad for anyone that we booked, but looking back. But you know, we got exposed to a whole lot of different stuff. You know, some of it like a lot of it hardcore, a lot of it just different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of, and it really, like, you can't, I mean, we're none of us, we aren't like angry people. So it's kind of like the aggression of it all kind of gave way to just trying to explore. I don't know. I think that's kind of what we had in mind. I mean, Christy Front Drive really did kind of open up, you know, Christy Front Drive, Sunny Day Real Estate, bands like that. It's like, those were people that were on the same level of, you know, I guess, like, you know, just, they were in the popular musical samplings that we were around,
mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, of course, like, as music fans, we just assimilate as much as we can of everything that we, you know, that interests us. And, you know, some of it got expressed through what we were doing as like, you know, exploring melody and slower and more moody kind of songs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it totally does, because it's like the, you know, I mean, Eric, I think, you know, embarrassed you a bunch. I mean, I think on the podcast, I think this is your chance too, to embarrass Eric. but, you know, he, you know, just, you know, spoke about meeting you guys and, you know, talking about your hair and all those kinds of things and just, you know, how different it was. And it really was that time of, you were really exposed to so much stuff at that time and it was coming at you so fast. And there wasn't a web search. It was, I saw the band or I read it in the liner notes and I'm going to check out that band because they mentioned them, or, oh, Sensefield's cool or Braid's cool.
I mean, it's like, or MRR had a column where a dude raved about some band and, you know, I got to go find their 7-inch now.
Yeah. And it was this search thing. It was this quest to go look. And I think that's, I'd like to get your kind of take. I mean, it took a little effort.
Oh yeah. The record store was like, you know,
it took effort.
A kick-ass record store. It was like a holy pilgrimage, mm-hmm. You know, like there's a spot in Tucson, in Arizona, called Toxic Ranch. And I think it was Toxic Shock. I think it was Toxic Branch. But it was like there was a venue called Downtown Performance Center. And it was like an all ages, no alcohol kind of, you know, spot. It was really cool. And there was a record store next to it that always had, without fail, anything that you were looking for. So it was like this, you know, and also, you know, there were spots all around town in Phoenix too, like East Side Records and Stinkweed Records. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was always like, it was a holy pilgrimage to go to these spots and like load up on the things that you couldn't find anywhere else. So that was a big part of that experience. You know, it wasn't easy. it's never been a better time to be a music fan than right now, where you can just like click, 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 click. Oh yeah, Pink Floyd discography. Click. I want to. I'll listen to all of it.
It's like, oh well, that band connects to that band, and then that. Oh okay, I get it. Well, that took me a month and three shows and 2 7-inches, you know, and then an issue with Metal Maniacs or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I had to like, I had to knock down walls with the sledgehammer and set up the milk crate stage so I could, you know, hear karate for the first time. You know, like that's kind of, yeah.
Karate was the first band I ever interviewed for my two issue zine that I did in high school.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eamon agreed to do it over email. They were on tour with Fugazi in Vermont, and he did the interview for me. It was like one of those things where I'm like, I don't know why you agreed to this, but thank you. Your band is awesome.
Yeah. That's funny. Like, I mean, getting back to that whole thing, I mean, that's how I met Eric and the Chrissy Prentrop dudes and, you know, our really lame production company that we had. And like, he'd send us copies of their record and, you know, get a show, or and karate sent us like, it's kind of a cassette of like demos.
Wow.
Of like early version. Like, I wish to God I still had it because it was awesome. There was one song they did called Dating and Stupid that was just awesome. To this day, I want to find it.
Oh,
but
wow.
It was like early version of like Cherry Coke and, mm-hmm. you know, like six instrumental songs. They were just bizarre.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I know. I need to go hunt that down somewhere someone has it.
Jeff has it. Jeff Rea's got it somewhere in his house, right?
Yeah, maybe, you know.
I mean, back then it was all about, you know, the split 7-inches, the splits, the, you know, joint tours. Were those things, are, you know, of course the emo diaries too. I mean, I think you probably heard on the podcast, or I've mentioned the band I was in was on the 7th one, not as cool at all. Did that open doors for you guys being on that? Were there things that kind of came from that, people hearing it?
I mean, well, like Eric was saying, like if someone was calling, if someone's knocking on your door wanting to put out music for you, I mean, you pretty much just took that because that was an incredible thing, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, our loftiest goal in the world when we started the band was to have our music on a 7-inch.
Wow.
You know, I mean, like, that, then you're like, you did something, man. You made something.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think that's, the, like, doing split records and, you know, networking with bands, helping them when they came to your town, you know, doing regional things with them when you were in their area. I mean, that all was like the main way that you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And still to this day, I think that's probably like the best way you can make an impression on somebody is to just go and play for them.
Yeah, definitely.
And have their friends, you know, evangelize for you on your behalf when you're gone, so that the next time you come to town, there's more people.
Yeah,
play a different place. Or,
the first time there's five, the next time there's 15. You know, those five people told a bunch of their friends, and then they all came out. Yeah, and it definitely grew. I mean, it felt like a, you know, an actual fan base instead of a like.
Right, right. It's not a passive thing, man. All these kids are like, you know, I mean, I'm sure that like some of the spots that we played are kind of like, you know, none of us could get. I mean, well, you know, you can't get into a bar. And, you know, know, so here in these places are, you know, just kind of wherever you, wherever they can exist, you know, even fleetingly. You know, we never played one of these shows, but I've heard of other people playing, like, in the post office.
Wow.
Late at night, because they had outlets and it's unlocked. And they would just, like, set up and do punk shows, like, in a mailbox kind of area in the post office. And then just bail. I think that might be, like, a rural Arizona thing.
Yeah. It's sort of the VFW hall for Arizona.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it took a lot of effort to do that, you know. I mean, as a music fan, even.
Yeah, no, the effort behind it, yeah, for sure. I mean, putting out those records, distributing them, making sure all the people had them, you know, having stuff at the shows, all that stuff was. It's not just like, oh, well, just go to our site, you can listen to us. You had to do something. I think probably you got asked this a million times, you know, during Bleed American and stuff. I mean, the word emo itself, initial thoughts when you had heard the word, had you any idea, did you, any sort of understanding of it? And, you know, since, is it something that was like, you know, kind of a blessing in disguise kind of thing?
For me, I think when someone says hardcore, that could mean something really different if you grew up in Long Beach or if you grew up on Long Island, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and for me, from my perspective in Arizona, you know, hardcore was always synonymous with like, the kind of more screamo hardcore. I mean, like, and I guess like emo was never really used, but that is kind of what, you know, I think in other places, but kind of stuff that I would consider hardcore was being called emo in other places. You know, I think like, and that specific kind of sound for me were bands like Julia or Mohinder or Ballsy of Three, Shotmaker, like the Abolition stuff, Gravity stuff, Quick Attack Italia would be one, like you know. Thing, like, this
Frail,
like bloodletting. What's that?
Frail from Philly.
Yeah, Frail. Like, yeah, Frail. Like the you know, I mean, the sort of like performance art bloodletting, basically. You know, like that's what I think of whenever I would hear the word emo, as we, you know, kind of got bigger and people were you know, throwing that word around to mean. You know, a haircut.
Yes.
and a white belt and a haircut. Like that's kind of, I never really got that. I mean, I can understand why people wanted to kind of, I mean, everyone wants to take credit for breaking the story on the next big thing. And I can understand why people want to give it a name like that. But for me, it's sort of, unless you're talking about, you know, groups like, unless you're talking about bands like from that time and that era and it's sort of, it doesn't mean the same thing to me. I mean, I don't know. Everyone, but then again, you know, you get a room full of people and ask them what punk means, you'll get a room full of different answers. So it's kind of not really, it's sort of a lazy way, I think, of describing a scene or a sound, because it really doesn't. I mean, hell, man, Darkness on the Edge of Town is pretty emo when it gets down to it.
Yep.
But no one's gonna call the Boss an emo act. You
know? Nope. Yeah, no, I mean, it did turn into sort of a, you know, a haircut and a style, and that's kind of the inspiration behind the website that I started. I'd just be like, look, there's these bands before that, yes, it came from, you know, it all kind of came from hardcore, and it's, you know, had this cycle to it, and that's kind of been the inspiration. And of course, now, I don't know if you know, but there's a lot of bands and labels that are sort of talking and sort of referencing bands before that sort of hair era. Count Your Lucky Stars, Top Shelf Records, a bunch of bands kind of, it's been really interesting to see them say, oh, well, my favorite band is, you know, I really love Engine Down, you know, and you're like, what? You know, how did you know about that? You know, but they searched it out and they figured it out and they found out about them. I think that's really interesting that they can quickly find out about it faster.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, there's I mean, like I said before, it's never been a better time to be a music fan because you can hunt down these like niches and of a scene that was, you know, no bigger than 50 people in a basement.
Yep.
And, you know, find something there that you might be into, you know, it's great.
Yeah, no, it's definitely exciting. I want to talk about a band that I know that you're super into and something that's kind of funny, kind of pre-social networking. I know you're a huge Guided by Voices fan.
Yeah, it's disgusting, really.
So I got to work with them when I was at TVT Records. And it was the first time I met Bob Pollard. I was doing college radio, and the only thing he said to me, he was shit-faced drunk. We're at Swift's in Lower East, or the Village, and he's like, I want my record to go number one at college radio. That's all he said to me. And I go, okay. And it was super fun, you know, working. And then I think I had found out that you were a fan from Frosty on the message board. Are you?
Oh, yeah.
And I sent the collapse to Bob to sign a record for you, and then Frosty was gonna give it to you. Do you even have that, or do you remember that at all? If not, that's fine.
You know, I think I do have a signed digipack somewhere, and Frosty might have given it to me.
Okay,
I remember that.
Because I remember Bob. Can I send this to you? There's a guy that's a huge fan. He's like, okay. And then he sent it. It was just one, but it took so long because it was like a message board. It wasn't, you know, a quick Facebook message or a text or a, you know.
No.
Anyway,
that was kind of like on the cusp of. That was on the cusp of everything really changing.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah.
But anyway, what do you like most about GBV? I had a college roommate that was a huge Guided by Voices fan, and it was a joy to work with him and see the performance and the output of music. That's the thing I love about him. They just put tons of tunes out.
Yeah, they did like 3 albums this year.
Yeah.
And God knows how many like solo albums are in the wings ready to come out. Like, yeah, sort of. I guess I just like the how... kind of like it's just like this beautiful, you know, slightly demented pop songs, you know, that are kind of like presented in a like a just the most beautifully broken kind of way, you know. Mm-hmm. Like it's just teetering, everything's just almost gonna fall apart, you know, but it doesn't. It holds it together, and somehow everyone hits the last note on time. And, you know, it's just catchy. I don't know. It's just sort of like it's an interesting way to present, like, hooks, mm-hmm. I think. When they're really cooking, when Bob and Tobin or whatever iteration of GBV that you're listening to, I mean, when it's really working well, it's kind of, you know, I mean, there's like a, it's just a really good mix of you know, of being just beautifully broken.
Yeah,
it's so right on. I mean, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's like that. They're almost. You're right. It's you're almost gonna fall apart. But wow, that chorus was huge.
I mean, I was just amazed by that song "Drag Days" that there is on "Under the Bushes Under the Stars" because I thought it was like just such a like intelligently constructed song, mm-hmm. you know, it's like pretty much just this perfect thing. I mean, whether or not you think like the hooks are like, you know, it's not Call Me Maybe, but it's got like this most, it's just the most intelligently constructed like pop song that I've, you know, that I've heard pretty much up until then, you know, like in just the right way, the right mixture I don't know. Like I don't want to say a swagger to it, but like a you know, just just, you know, here it is, man. Mm-hmm. We don't care. Like, we're doing this because it's fun, and here you go.
And in another two minutes, there's going to be another one. Mm-hmm. Nonstop. that's cool. Yeah, I just, the reason I brought it up, too, is that, you know, Bob's still going, still putting out stuff. And I think for you guys, I mean, lasting this long as a band, many bands from there have broken up, left, come back together. You know, what's the kind of balance that you guys, for you, what's the secret? Is it, it's, you guys can get away enough and come back and every, it's, I'd just love to hear what you guys, the secret sauce.
Yeah, I know. It's like, for a while there was like, I would get asked in interviews, like, hey, everyone's pretty much broken up from your era. And like, well, we got Piebald. but now Piebald broke up. So, like, it's kind of, yeah, I don't know. I mean, we were friends before we started the band. I've known the drummer, Zach. His mother was our preschool teacher, mm-hmm. which is bizarre to think of. But, I think we all have a, you know, just really healthy outlook on being able to do what we do. It's totally getting away with something. You know, and we appreciate like every second of it. I mean, you have to. It's kind of like none of us thought that we'd be. It was really only until maybe recording Chase This Light that I thought, like, hey, I'm kind of doing this. this is sort of like a career, this is sort of a job, like, I'm doing this.
Wow.
Like, holy cow, I'm doing this, you know, like, it's what I do. Like, it's bizarre to think that, and it's something that none of us ever thought we would be able to do. So I don't know. We're just grateful, I think, for being able to do that. And I think,
It's kind of like you guys have hit your stride.
We've also been incredibly lucky too.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Clarity being an amazing record and having people kind of gravitate to that, and then having, you know, Bleed American kind of come out, and, you know, have that little song. It was the A&R guy at TVT handed me the demo record that you sent around to all the labels. He's like, hey, you like this band. Here you go. And I was like, really? I was like, this thing's amazing. You know? And he's like, yeah, you know, no. But it was that kind of from, wow, we sent, right? I mean, you sent the record out everywhere. And then to have that happen, I mean, that's like an amazing thing to happen.
Oh yeah, and I mean we know that we're lucky. we know we're extremely lucky.
Yeah,
like we just appreciate everything that we're able to do.
And definitely.
Come on, man! Like it's rock and roll, and we get to play music. I mean, it's kind of you're gonna foul that up with like quitting.
Yeah.
or thinking that like you need to do your solo accordion record, or you know what I mean?
I mean, is it, are you on a cycle where it's like you've got Happy Family, you got everything, you know, is you know, you've got a cycle where it's, we've got, all right, we're going to tour, we're going to do this, then take a year off. I mean, is that something you guys see continuing? It just seems like it's in such a good pattern, and that's not in a bad way. It just seems like
I can see how that must look from an outside perspective, but you don't really ever clock out of this gig. You know, there's always something that you're doing. There's always something that you're working on. There's mm-hmm. always, I mean, whether or not, I mean, you have the satisfaction of throwing it away in your own trash bin if it's no good, but I mean, you're always working on something. It does take a little bit of time for us to get records out and stuff,
with social media doesn't stop, you know, so that's something that you guys are always kind of, it's like that's another one on top of it, that you're always kind of up to.
Yeah, I mean, I know, of course. I mean, we just made an album and it's, you know, we're kind of finishing up artwork and stuff, and we just had band practice yesterday where we were talking about writing new material. So it's kind of, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't stop. You never clock out.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of it. I mean, I don't, you know, it's fun.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's
really fun.
That's the, I mean, I think it is something that I, you know, I think people that listen to this podcast and people that are fans, I mean, I think they're happy. They're happy that the middle happened. They're happy that the, you know, clarity came out. They're happy that the last record came out, the invented and chase this light. It's like, you're still out there still doing it. I think if you stopped, I think obviously you guys would, you know, whatever situation, but I think you've hit a stride where if you play, you know, Chicago, there's people showing up and that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, I see what you mean by that. I mean, there's definitely, I mean, there's a base level. I think as long as we feel like you'll never be able to predict what people are going to like. But I think like the great thing for us is that this entire time we've been pretty honest with ourselves as far about what we present musically is something that we're all proud of. And I mean, that's really the only thing you can control in this whole crazy world, just be proud of your work and, you know, be really honest with yourself as far as that goes. And I think the people who have found something in what we do, that they can relate to, or they can, you know, adapt to, you know, find something in for themselves, you know, they appreciate that. And we've become successful with that method, and we can do pretty much anything we want now.
You know what Which I mean? Is what any band wants.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have to follow up, we don't have to follow up, the runaway hit, mm-hmm. you know, with something that sounds exactly like it, because it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in keeping a mindset like with what you're saying, like we can just continue to do what we do. I think that's the goal for anyone. You know, I mean, the music you put out should enable you to continue to put out music.
Yeah.
If you're honest with yourself, if you're honest with yourself about putting out the work that you're proud of, then there's no reason that can't happen.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, and I think, you know, everyone would say, you know, keep going, don't stop. I mean, too, as everyone gets older, the catalog gets deeper, it's harder and harder to play old songs. You know, any thoughts on, you know, set lists now as the catalog gets deeper? Is there any songs that, you know, you'd want to play but don't because of that? Or just there's you know, one guy in the band will say, you know, Tom will be like, no way, we're not playing that. Or is it just kind of you guys have... you're like, we
no,
want to play the new
no,
shit.
I don't know. I mean, like, I think it's just kind of like whatever we're, I mean, you're always excited about
the new shit.
Yeah. I think anybody's like that. So you're always excited about like, hey, just wrote the song, man, check it out. Like, you're always excited about that. You want to share that. But I mean, I think the next time we tour, we'll probably have, you know, I mean, like tons of material. So, and I feel like, we're at a point now where we should have most of it being able to, you know, sub in on a nightly basis. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, in the past we've kind of gotten locked into like two or three different kind of set lists with various changes, you know, depending on what our mood was like. But I really want to be able to mix things up like on a drastic scale. I think we can do that. You know, I mean, we're going to want to play new stuff, but I think we can do a longer show now and have it be okay and like mix in a whole lot of like, you know, stranger, older stuff.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, that's that kind of thing. You guys can kind of pick and choose and say, okay, we didn't do this one last time. We can do this. It's instead of being like, oh Jesus, we just have to play our whole last record because we don't have enough time. There's plenty of time. So I think that's another great thing. It's like a fan now going doesn't know, okay, what are they going to play next or what kind of deep cut or what song off the last record that they didn't play on that tour kind of thing, which I think is
right.
Great for fans.
Right. One thing we also want to do is kind of like start recording the shows and having them like available, you know, so people can check it out.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's something we've been talking about doing. I'd love to nail down the logistics of that. I mean, it seems like it's getting easier and easier to do that. With you know, like the DigiDesign the DigiDesign profile boards that a lot of people are carrying around, or a lot of people have in their house,
mm-hmm.
like in venue. I mean, you can plug right into that and multi-track your show.
So you're thinking record the show and then
next
day, the next day have it available, or something, you know, later on have, okay, here's the, you know, best of this tour.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's totally just shooting from the hip right now, but I mean, that's something that like the technology is there. So
mm-hmm.
it'd be great to capitalize on that. And like, you know, as a music, we've always tried to make decisions about how we present our work as like from the perspective of music fans, and being able to have a copy of the show you were at and have it sound good is something that I would love as a music fan when I see a, like a good show.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, whether you like them or not, like, I think, like Linkin Park does a great job at that. Like, you can go on the website.
They have a great fan club.
I can't believe I just said you should go to Linkin Park.
I think that's a first, Jim, for the podcast.
Yeah, well, I'm all about breaking down boundaries, you know, breaking down walls.
Oh,
it's all about piecing together, and yeah. But seriously, like they have a great. It's not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that, but they have a great way that they respect their fans. You know, like, you can pretty much get any show they've ever done, like. And there's no reason, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I think everyone should do that.
Yeah. Well, I think it was cool for the, you know, the Clarity Tour to have the live record available.
I mean, that was important to us. We put a lot of work into that, and it was important to us to, you know, to do that. I don't think we'll be so amped up on anniversaries for albums in the future, but I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, it is kind of a sham. Like, as time goes on, it's like, yeah, this man's album's 10 years old. Yeah, this band's album's 10 years old. It's kind of, you know, I don't want to milk that, but I mean, people are, they'll do something special for records, but.
Yeah. Well, it was funny that I live near the Beacon Theater, and I walk by there a bunch to go to work and bike by it. Every time I look up, and it's like, this band's 45th anniversary of this record. I'm like, holy crap, or whatever it is. It's just like, how many times can they keep doing this? Or we're playing this album tonight. It feels like it's gone everywhere.
It's gone viral. Just take a leap.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There was one thing from the 10th anniversary shows that I will embarrass myself, but I thought it was important. I wanted the full version of Goodbye Sky Harbor. And I remember that there was some – I made some joke-like petition or something, and a bunch of people signed it. And I think Absolute Punk mentioned – it was one of these kind of funny things. I'm like, wow, I just did something – I wrote something down, and now everyone's kind of – jumping on it. And I remember Zach like laughing about it on some live stream, or I saw like a quote. Were you guys conscious of that, or were you, because the version you would play before would be, you know, 5 or 6, it'd have a little heavy like breakdown in it, but obviously, you know, for the anniversary shows it went on longer. Did you guys, you know, think about like, god, how long do we have to do this one, or did you think you were just going to play like the old version? Not the old version,
well,
but the one that you did live.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, for us, there's been this process of, like, well, you have your, you know, your initial idea for a song, you know, it's
on however you choose to document that, whether it's a multi-track recording, whether it's a, you know, dictaphone, or whether it's like a iPhone voice message now, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever, sheet music. I don't know. However you document your new idea. And then it goes into like a, I mean, if you're working with other people, it goes into a collaboration kind of phase, a group editing phase, if you will. And then it becomes something else. And then, you know, you try to execute that in a way that you can present it for people, which is your recording. Then after that recording, I mean, if you're anybody like us, where we just kind of decide the recording is the, that's kind of the most important thing, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, like, I don't know. People obsess about being able to document their performance.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, like, we want to capture how it's going to be. But I don't know. I've always thought that's kind of, it's silly to limit yourself if you want to hear other things. So that's just me. I mean, you know, it works. It's basically a song by song sort of thing, but that's just me. More often than not, I'm the more is more type of guy. and so you do all that, and then after that, you have to figure out how to play it again. So you know, kind of listen to stuff and figure out what the most important hooks are and how you're going to cover them. And with adapting Goodbye Sky Harbor for you know, initially when we were just doing clubs and stuff, I was like, well, let's flip it. There's no way we can perform this live because, you know, it's 16 minutes long and there's no way. We only have like two singers, so it's not going to happen. how can we do it? And we just decided to flip the dynamics to where the quiet stuff was really loud and, you know, just kind of made like a 5-minute adaption of it. And with the Clarity Tour, it was like, well, we wanted to be more faithful to the record, but we didn't want to make people
sleep.
Really thought it would be boring. To have people sit through 13, you know, 60 minutes,
yeah.
However long it is. A real tape worth of la la la, do 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 stuff.
Yes.
So, you know, we kind of like, you know, it just.
I called it the extended jam. I think you guys jammed on it, and then that was it. I think it was done well.
Yeah, you know, sort of like the most important parts of it, where you can understand and get the original concept, and then, but not too. You know, man, you gotta like. There's a cliche that is, you know, most that everybody in music would do well to pay heed to. It's leave while they're still clapping.
So yeah, ending on Goodbye Sky Harbor might be the
yeah if you, end. Yeah. You don't want 16 la 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 la.
I could just picture that where everyone like there's one guy like clapping.
Hey, all right, bro. Hey. Yeah. No.
You guys
no,
thought about
no.
it. That was smart.
We tried.
Yeah. No, you did. That was good. I think too. I think you know, kind of those longer songs from Futures. You know, 23, Night Drive. Those are some you know really really great songs. Is that something that does that start on you know a jam, or is that something where you kind of just is it conscious to have it something kind of be that epic or sort of that crescendo?
No, it's really just like everything is a reaction to what you're hearing, you know? So if there's your initial idea, like I think with 23, I don't know. I write a lot of songs like where I start playing drums, which is funny because like I'm ripping off what ends up happening is Zach plays drums, you know, to me ripping off him playing drums. I'm horrible at playing drums, but like, but, you know, just having like some sort of a loop, like rhythm thing to play guitar, you know,
can help you write riffs. Sort of like, yeah.
Yeah. I think like it might have been the beat that came first on that, or the riff. I don't know, for 23, but like, you know, I don't know. It's always easier to react to something than to look at a blank page. So
yeah.
If you can, I mean, that's why I think you ask anybody who writes music on guitar will tell you that if they have a new effect pedal or if they slide the capo up and down on the neck, like you write a new song, that's the instant. That's the, you get a new toy and you write a song around that toy.
Yep.
Or you make a new tuning on your guitar, you write a song for that tuning.
My downfall was drop D.
Yeah. That yeah, was... I'm trying to get out of the drop D pitfall. But
yeah, because it's just so easy, but you're like, I can't keep doing this.
I like, you know what, I just like the, I like the idea, I like the full chord to hit open D.
Yes.
But, and I also like doing the bar chord, like the A position bar chord, mm-hmm. like where you can hear, like the lower octave of the D string, but I don't like, but yeah, you know, Helmet can only take that so far. And they were Helmet.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, that's why I started doing it. It's like, well, I have to do start, stop riffs and drop D. That's what I just need to write. And then it's like, they kind of went and it's like, oh, that's how far, you, or prong too. They kind of did it, but not to the.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you're trying to get out of drop D. I think there's a support group. I think it's, I'm just kidding. I always,
there should be. There should be. There should be a drop E support group.
Are you lazy about riffs?
Yeah. Drop D and on.
Drop D and on. Well, if you'd want to start one, we can. We can see who's interested.
Dude, you probably look online and see a Facebook page right now for drop D and on.
You're right.
You know, for real.
Yeah. I thought too, I mean, something that a lot of people had asked on the message, or not the message board, excuse me, I'm talking like it's Makeout Club, on the Facebook page about Go Big Casino. Any more plans with that, or?
No. I mean, that started as like, I got asked to do a solo show for a charity, like in 99. Mm-hmm. And I felt like just super pretentious saying, here's Jim Adkins. So,
you just came up with a name. Thought,
yeah. So I decided to call it something and that was that. And, you know, a bunch of songs got written underneath that. And, you know, I mean, I think like I've never thrown anything away and you can always, you know, because you can always cannibalize your ideas for something. You never know when you're working on something and you know, you're stuck. But this older idea that you never ended up using just seems to work out perfectly, you mm-hmm. know? Actually, I cannibalized an early Go Big Casino idea for a song that's going to be on our new album.
Ah,
so you never know
where it's going to come
from. You never know when something's going to, you should never throw anything away. Always keep a recording of everything you do. It's especially now that like.
It's so easy.
Data. Yeah. Memory is so cheap. You know, storage is so cheap, dude. Don't throw away anything. Just put it away. You know, be Neil Young, update your drives every 3 years.
Well, I think a lot of fans love that you know, either officially or not officially have demo versions of songs. I think a lot of people like to kind of see the difference between certain ones.
Yeah. I mean, that's a music fan thing for me. I love hearing like early versions of tunes.
Yeah. I think, so, you know, I think cool the Futures to... record was awesome to hear the side by side.
Oh, cool. Oh yeah. Cool. Yeah. I mean, we have our own, like rehearsal space / studio in Arizona here, and we're big on demoing and redemoing. You know, like if someone has an idea that we think is valid that will take the song in a completely different direction, we'll just record it from scratch again. yeah, well, it doesn't matter. We'll just do it. Yeah, I mean, because, like, that's the only way to really tell. It's the only way. I mean, you can get only so far with, like, even – I think I'm pretty good at digitally editing and moving around, but you can only get so far before the feel is just so wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, where it's not – where it's only academic, and you have to – there's no way around it. You don't know unless you cut it again, you know, with the feel that's changed. So, you know, I think with a lot of stuff from Futures, I mean, there was stuff that was like starting with Futures actually, and then everything since then, I mean, things get demoed like 5 or 6 times before we end up on a final arrangement, production trajectory.
Well, I mean, too, I mean, some of those, like, Futures, you know, I think Shame was left off, which is a great song. Open Bar Reception with Chase This Light, which is, like, a huge request for the emo night that we do in New York City. People love that song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it always gets someone to come up and be like, is this Jimmy Eat World? I'm like, yeah. They're like, holy crap. Like, so, you know, I think...
I always like that song. It was kind of...
My personal request for the upcoming tour, add that song to the set list. I'm telling you, people are going to be stoked on it.
It's a party.
It is.
You know, it's funny. It's like Zach cut the drums to that. Like, I put down some weirdo, like, really sketchy kind of drums, and he cut drums, I think, like 157 overhead. And that's what's on the album. That's what's on that version that you probably have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. It's just funny sometimes. Like, I think that the whole idea about recording and being precious about sound is kind of, I mean, just use your ears. You know, if something sounds cool, go with it. If something doesn't sound cool, change it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really have to know. You don't have to know. I mean, I don't know. Knowing the rules to audio engineering helps you understand what, you know, how you can push yourself to break them. But it's no big deal if you just start off breaking all the rules. Like, no, I mean, use your ears. If something sounds cool, keep at it. If something doesn't sound cool, change. It's like the Cusack movie.
High Fidelity.
That one, Crazy Summer. Not One Crazy Summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, go that way. Somebody gets in the way, turn.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, too, I mean, the band The Michelle Gunn Elephant, they recorded with one mic in the middle of the room. And that's the
record. Better off dead.
Oh, Better Off Dead. No, that's fine.
That would have bugged. Yeah, Elephant. Sorry to interrupt your Elephant story, but that would have bugged me all night if I couldn't remember Better Off Dead. So... Sorry, but yeah, Elephant, like, those guys are awesome, man. Diego is like,
but it's like one
awesome.
Mic and it sounds great, and you're like, okay, well, that works, and it works for you guys.
Sure.
So I think you should add Open Bar Reception. Feel free to bring that back to the band. One person will be stoked, and the 5 other people that hear it then be like, what the hell is this?
I think, like, yeah, I mean, like, I really want to get, like, just a ton of older stuff ready to go, or, like, less played stuff ready to go, and, like, pepper in that stuff every night. It happens.
Because it kind of breaks it up a little bit, just, I mean, for you guys, too. It's not like the, you know, the sort of, not going through the motions, but you're like, whoa, this is changing up tonight. We need to, kind of keeps you on your toes, almost.
You have to do stuff that really scares the hell out of you. You have to.
I think too, I mean, I wanted to kind of talk about the future. And I think a lot of people are interested. I mean, is there anyone that you'd want to collaborate with? I know the Taylor Swift thing was pretty impressive. That I saw online. Is there, you know,
dude, yeah. How crazy is that?
I was blown away. I was like, wait a minute. Did I read this headline correct? That's so badass. How did you get up on that stage?
How did I come to play with her, or how did I physically get up on stage?
Well, I figured you walked up on stage.
Those are two great stories each.
Okay, I'll take. How'd you connect with Miss Swift?
Her people talked to my people.
Ah.
They said they're like her management company, which I think is her dad. Like, she has the most insane setup. Insane. Absolutely insane. Totally smart. Totally, I mean, like, yeah, insane, but totally smart. I mean, like, she has her own bus company.
Wow.
She is her own bus company, her own trucking company, her own booking agent, her own management company. She's pretty much everything except for her own label. And then plus she has like her crazy ass Revlon endorsements and stuff. But I mean, like, she's like super, super smart for like on a business level. She's super, super smart. And she's like, there's a girl who goes to, I'm sure this is the first time that you've had like discussions about like praise for Linkin Park and Taylor Swift on your podcast. But, like,
that's fine.
But seriously, I'm just about breaking down boundaries, man. You know. But seriously, okay. So there's a girl who goes to the school that my youngest son goes to, who has is in remission right now, but she had like gnarly cancer, young child. And when I found out about, I mean, I knew that she was like a super fan of Taylor Swift. And when I found out I was gonna be playing, it was like, you know, me and my wife, like, we decided, like, do you guys want tickets? You know, you want to come and see the show? And Taylor Swift had already reached out to her family through the Ronan Rockstar Foundation.
Yes,
the Ronan thing. She wrote a song about like that was another kid in our community who died from cancer, and they were affiliated, like the parents who they were affiliated with, like, that group. And she reached out to them, and they already had tickets. They already had the most exclusive, crazy package, you know, where you can come see and hang out with Taylor Swift. You know, it was, you know, she made an outgoing attempt to do that before I'd even thought about it.
Wow.
You know, so she has her act together as a business person, and she has her act together way more than, you know, on an ethical level, more than a lot of punk rocker people have been.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just doing those little things that, you know, maybe they only know about. And
totally, yeah. She there's no press release about that crap. But, like, that happened. Like, she hooked a little girl up who was going through chemo, you know, and had one of the most amazing nights that she'll never forget, you know? And on top of everything else, like, she's doing great now. Like,
that's so great.
Yeah, it's pretty rad. I mean, but you know, to get back to a lighter note, I ended up on stage through the ground floor, like on an elevator, with smoke and like,
yes,
all sorts of crap.
That was awesome. It was a total.
She has like,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
is that, I mean, like, is that for has, set like, changes and stuff?
No, it's just for because.
Oh, it's awesome. Just because.
It's because.
Just
because she can. Her crew is pretty much like, I think when Metallica is off, like, she has their whole crew.
Wow.
Like, setting up gnarly, you know, stages everywhere.
So you came up on an elevator with smoke.
Yeah. It sort of brings it full circle into the Quiet Riot, you know, kind of.
It totally does. You know?
It's not, given this entire conversation, it's really not all that
you know, out of character to want to rise from the depths of smoke and on a catwalk.
Yes.
In front of an arena.
was that totally fun to play? I mean, obviously, being such a different audience,
totally.
But they all knew the song, I'm sure, most of them.
They sort of did, I think. I don't know. I got a whole lot of cred on my street after that.
Yes, you did.
The neighborhood girls like cooking the show, like they... All of a sudden, oh yeah, I can do it. That's cool.
You're like, man, I've been doing this forever.
No, it's funny.
Is there anyone else that you want to do anything with or sing with?
I think like Scott from Fried and Rabbit. It's a dude I'd love to work with. Jim Ward. We've kind of like been going back and forth over the years about like... you know, having a little project called The Gyms with a Z. But we haven't found any other gym people we really dig to be in the band.
Yeah, we got to find more gyms.
Yeah, we need more gyms. I don't know. I mean, I just love playing. I love working on music. Like, it's kind of... You never know what's going to come up.
Yeah, exactly. That's what kind of the thing. It's like you listed off a couple, but then, you know, tomorrow your manager could call and say, hey, well, this person, this, and this, and then this whole rabbit hole, you know, thing happens where something else comes about. So, yeah, that makes sense.
I hope so. I hope so. That'd be fun. Yeah, that sounds great.
And then just a few kind of more just kind of about the future. I mean, you have an old model of your Telecaster, Fender, which is pretty badass.
I know, is that nuts?
That is pretty badass. So I can't afford one. Wait, did I get it for it? I don't know if I could. I think when it came out, I was like, holy crap. I was making no money, you know, in the music biz, so I had no money.
I think you can pick up the exact thing that I play for like $700.
Oh, okay. It's gone down then. Thank you, Fender. Thank you.
Well, that was sort of the point. That was sort of the point of that. Like, I wanted to make it like something that I would play, and it's something that like
someone could get.
You know, it's just, well, yeah. It's probably not someone's first guitar, but maybe their second or third. I don't know.
Yeah. How did that come about? Was it something that they reached out to you and?
Well, Fender, their main headquarters is here in Arizona, in Scottsdale. Mm-hmm. Like, actually, not too far from our studio, from our practice place. And a buddy of mine, a guy named Jeff Livingston, who's like in San Diego now playing in bands, he's like, hey man, you should check out the guitar. It was like the TC90, which is like a double cutaway, glue-on neck Telecaster with P90s. And I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. I mean, the only person I've ever seen play a third body or a glue on neck telly was in Smoking Popes, and he got that at like the crazy custom shop. But I wrote back to him like, you know what, it would be cool, like, can you make this with like a you know, I play Les Paul, so can you make the pickups, you know, with a separate tone and volume and a toggle on the horn? Instead of like by the traditional, like, you know, down by the knobs,
which I always hit with my hand.
Yeah, which but you always knock off the knob and then lacerate your hand when you're switching pickup. which basically just lives with a piece of duct tape on it.
Yes.
So like, and he was like, you know what, dude, just come in. Let's figure something out. Like, let's do a guitar. And so I came in like, okay. And it just kind of went back and forth and did some prototypes and found, you know, just, I don't know.
That's awesome.
With what is now the JA90.
Nice. JA90.
I know, it's so weird. And they've kept it too. I mean, we're not like, I mean, I guess we do okay, but we're not like, I'm not like Yngwie and Malmsteen. Like, there's not like, you know, I'm not like a guitar player that's shredding, but I'm not Shreddy Krueger.
Yes.
Out there evangelizing for you know, on the cover of Guitar World or whatever.
Your guitar doesn't have scalloped frets, which Yngwie's does.
Well, no, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
we're
no,
not,
I do.
We do okay, but we're not Yeah, you're not Slash. Yeah, I can't have my own signature model Slash that's around forever. I don't know. I guess like it's doing okay.
That's great.
And I'm proud of it.
Nice. Quickly, have you seen Yngwie Malmsteen before live?
I've never seen Yngwie Malmsteen live.
If you ever do, in between his songs, the lead singer comes out and sings his songs. He goes back behind the stage and has a mirror and does his hair. It's amazing.
Oh man. I would pay like double if there was a cam on him and like that was broadcast. So like you'd see him doing his hair.
Yes. That was the only thing I remember from the show, him doing his hair. Like just long, like blonde hair. Just, oh, it was awesome.
Just as long as I hear "The Queen Is in Love."
Yes.
Live, just once in my life. I want to hear "The Queen Is in Love."
That's awesome.
That's another first. Yngwie Malmsteen lyrics sung live on your podcast. This is another first.
This is unbelievable.
We're just breaking down boundaries here. Piecing togetherness.
And I'd love to kind of talk about the new record.
Sure.
And I, you know, kind of talking about what was, obviously everyone asks, you know, what was different, but I think being that most of the people listening to this know what all the records sound like, they know Mark Trombino, they know the Butch Vig, you know, I'd love to kind of talk about, you know, the new person that you worked with and what was kind of different about it. And the only thing I've kind of heard, and maybe it was an interview that you did, I heard it's kind of grittier, but that's one word out of a million that you could have picked. So,
well, we wanted to change it up. You know, we did our last couple of records at our spot, and, you know, we felt like we wanted to sequester ourselves in an environment where that's all we had to think about. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that was either get hotels and work out of our spot in town or leave town. And a guy named Al Yohannes, who was in a band called 11 for a long time, and sort of like he's kind of in like the Foo Fighters, Queens of the Stone Age camp, as far as like how most people would know him. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, but he also is like a, you know, fellow artist and really one of those dudes you hate as a musician because he can pick up anything and just start shredding.
Ugh.
Play really well at it, even if it's like his first time picking something up. He'll just pick it up and shred. You're like, oh. not too really. But you know, just an amazing sense of musicianship, and he's been like cutting records, like producing and engineering for a really long time. But also, you know, like he knows the rules, but doesn't care so much about following them, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, like, we cut our record at his house. Like, all of our amps were in his bedroom.
Wow.
Yeah, which is a... he has an insane amount of patience for that. But yeah, I mean, you know, we cut it at his house. Like, you know, it's sort of...
Was it something that you kind of felt that you felt comfortable? Did it feel different? Was it that the being with him or kind of having him mention things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the point of it was to let go, you know, because I didn't want an engineer. I wanted to just like perform and not think about, you know, that aspect of the whole recording process.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having someone else that can produce and engineer, you know, controlling everything was big. And yeah, I mean, you know, we did a lot of things we haven't done in a long time. Like we printed tape. There's pretty much no editing. There's a lot of comping, but there's no like, digital trickery,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better way to, you know, I don't know. Like one thing I think a trap I've fallen into is kind of using computer stuff to get my idea across is kind of like, but being kind of lazy on following through to redo it like, mm-hmm. in an organic way, just because it sounds fine.
but it doesn't. You know, you got to do it again. You got to like do it as an original, like an organic composition, and perform. And you know, that's pretty much all we did there was, you know, just I'd sing three times per song. We'd comp that, you know, for anyone not listening or for anyone listening that doesn't know what that means. That means like taking this section of a song from this take and putting it on this section from another song. It's pretty much, you know, just kind of taking the best from each performance and putting it all in one track. So that's what you hear. But no like pitch corrective software, no beat detective, no, I mean, it's really like the closest thing to a Static Prevails recording that we've done in a really long time.
Mm-hmm. And because was Static done that same way, or was it, you know?
Oh,
just
Static
because...
was all the tape.
Wow.
It was all the 24-track tape. Clarity was... The drums and bass were on tape and everything else was on Pro Tools. And Pro Tools chased the tape when we were mixing. Well, it's sort of like when you play back the tape, on the 24th track it's empty. It's like a time code thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the computer can talk to the tape and play back the things you recorded on computer along with the things that were off the tape. And then all that, yeah, and then all that goes through your mixing console to your master 2-track that you're printing to, which could be in some cases a DAT or in other cases like a 1/2-inch, you know, tape. Mm-hmm. or just print it back into Pro Tools and have it at whatever your session was, you know, whatever specs your session was created.
Wow. So did it feel, I mean, obviously it didn't feel like Static Prevails recording, but it must have, you know, was, you needed to keep doing it right. You needed to keep playing the song.
Oh, honestly, well, no, not really. Not really. I mean, we only played songs probably like, we only played or sang things three times and just picked the best one from that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're going to hear.
And then any other kind of tidbits from it? Is it obviously, you know, nothing you have to give away or anything, but just feeling, is it obviously every new record is, you know, this is our, you know, favorite and things, but it does seem different this time. It's kind of going back to square one a little bit.
Yeah. It's sort of, I guess it's sort of a lonely kind of record.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel like, you know, maybe part of the process of recording that way just helps sort of foster that kind of emotion for it. But like, you know, just kind of like us. I mean, I don't know. Like, in a way, it's kind of how we've always made records. Like just us in a room. And I mean, I don't know how people record. I can only speak for myself. I've been in studio situations with other people, you know, infrequently, but I can only speak for like our method. And it's not unlike any other time we've recorded where it's like us in a room and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, us and the people we've chosen to be in on the project, but that's it. There's no person looking over your shoulder, you know, telling you that, you know, you need more Pavel.
Mm-hmm.
or that the chorus isn't popping enough. I mean, there's no, but it's just all, you know, we know what to do.
Yeah.
We've been left alone. We've been so fortunate that we've been left alone to figure it out on our own.
That's so huge. Instead of having a guy come in and say, well, I think you should make that chorus 30 seconds, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, when we were cutting Clarity, our A&R guy for Capitol came by once. And that was the day that Billboard was taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I thought, oh, what a shoes, like that. But now I realize, like, he was the best A&R guy, like, it was that time. Because he just loved your stuff.
Yeah. I think for me this is Heaven Needs Another Chorus. You know, it's like, what? No, go away.
Yeah. Yeah, this is pretty good, but if you thought about Will I Am having a rap on this section.
Well, I know, because they always start with a compliment.
Don't laugh, man. Don't laugh. That's happened.
Oh, no. I just like that they start it with a compliment. They're like, you know, it sounds great, but.
That's the ultimate thing, like when you're doing a video, like a video shoot. That's perfect. One more time. One more time.
Did you guys have a video with some sports stuff in it? I'm trying to remember if you guys did. The Rockstar video.
We did. Yeah, we did.
Are you guys all huge
sports? No. It was for Lucky Never Mint, actually.
It was Lucky Never Mint. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Are you guys huge in the sports? Is it something that you guys are trying to do to kind
we're,
of offset?
We're huge in the Frisbee Golf.
Frisbee Golf. That's huge.
No, that video came about because we made Clarity, and we weren't getting any sort of feedback from the label, and it seemed like the label was sort of in turmoil. And I think it was right about the time that Gary Gersh left Capitol, and I don't know, we never really, like, you know, that big a priority for them, but. What happened was, like, so our A&R guy, he had the idea that, well, we should probably do, like, an EP or something to kind of help set up the record. Because, like, we're not getting any traction on the release date because no one knows who you are. Which is the truth, you know? I mean, we had no business. I mean, there was nobody waiting for Clarity to come out when it came out. Other than maybe the 4,000 people who bought Static Reveals and the other 3,000 people who bought our 7 inches. So we did an EP. We're lucky to have a couple songs in the record. That was what the Fueled by Ramen release is. And a couple songs that didn't make it onto the record, and a couple songs from Clarity. And then all of a sudden, K-Rock added Lucky Denver Mint in L.A., like one of the most influential commercial alternative stations in the country. And so Capitol, like, all of a sudden got a release date. All of a sudden, like...
Video budget.
Drew Barrymore decided she wanted to put that song in a movie that she was doing the executive producing the soundtrack
Never for. Been Kissed?
Yeah, Never Been Kissed. And I think we were playing for nobody in Fargo, and we got on a plane and flew to LA and cut that video with the dude, with Darren Doan, who we knew did the Promise Ring, a couple Promise Ring videos.
Yep.
Super awesome guy, super funny guy. And that, we just showed up and, you know, we talked to him once maybe on the phone about his concept for it, and like, you know, we'd never done anything like this before. And we made the video for Rockstar, which is, you know, a performance based kind of thing. But like, we had no idea. So we just showed up and like, that's what happened.
That's so crazy. I love it. I didn't know you. I forgot you did that with Darren Doan.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I think too. I mean, I want to, you know, don't want to keep you all night. I want to find out kind of what's next for you personally. I mean, is it something that, you know, the band, you got three boys to raise, and, you know, kind of, is there anything, you know, next for you?
I think it's just trying to do right by our next record, you know? I mean,
yeah.
We're really proud of the work we've done, and I think, like, the artwork is starting to come together. All those, like, last-minute final touches that kind of help define what the record is. Those are starting to happen. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's pretty much the most important thing for us right now.
And then, kind of, what have you most enjoyed about this whole ride? you know, this whole thing from kind of beginning to end? What was kind of the most enjoyable thing as you kind of look back?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I think I'm grateful for every minute I get to do what I love to do. I mean, really. I mean, it's just awesome.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good answer. No, because you're sort of looking forward rather than looking back. You're like, everything I've done before is moving forward.
It's not an attitude that I always had. It's something that kind of, like, because I was always in disbelief that I was always sort of putting off accepting the gratitude, you know. I was always, like, sort of waiting for it to all end instead of being happy for every second. And I think, like, when you're, you know, I mean, it's a subtle difference, but it makes all the difference.
And then I guess, too, I mean, what would you like someone to say when they look back at the work of the band? You know, would you want to, was there anything that you would be like, man, I hope someone says this? Or?
Well, no, I just hope that, like, I mean, honestly, I don't expect even our most hardcore fan to love everything that we do. That's unrealistic. It's not going to happen. It's not something I'm, it's not the approval I'm chasing. I think, like, I don't know, just the biggest compliment that anyone, the biggest, like, lasting thing that anyone can give you is just that they found something in what you do that they've made their own. And that could be as simple as a lyric in a song, or it could be as complex as, like, you know, a stretch of years or, in, you know, show. I don't know. I mean, I think just having someone be able to find something in what we do that they've made their own and connected with, that's just the hugest thing. It's not necessarily something we're chasing, but it definitely feels good when that happens, when someone tells you that.
You
want to know a super funny story?
Yeah.
So Eric had just moved to New York, I think when he was 22 or 23. And I think he's maybe a year older than me, but I was in New York. And we were doing a photo shoot the next day for Clarity, for like with Crazy Pepper. And we were at, oh man, some bar, like 7th and Avenue A.
7A? Or no, was it, Dimfa's? Dimfa's? Yeah, one of those over there. Yeah, one of those over there.
But it was sort of like, for some reason, like, Eric thought that, like, the candles on the table were plastic, and he threw one at me. And it smashed into my nose, and, like, I was, like, bleeding. I was, like, it's amazing to be kicked out of there because I was just, like, bleeding from my nose. And the next day I had to do it. The next day I had a photo shoot, and, if you look closely on the Clarity, like, the back cover, if you have the album or whatever, like, I have a fresh cut on my nose, and that's from Eric.
Oh, no shit. That's awesome.
So, yeah, I owe him one.
Yeah, seriously.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, it was super cool, like, just like driving around or running, listening to like Chris and Eric and, you know, Davey and everyone talk about those days, and it's kind of like, you know, it's bizarre that, like, people that I mean, there's this forum for this, there's a forum for, like, that insane, really, really small niche. When it comes down to it, I mean, seriously, it was like we did a show with Chris Event Drive in Minneapolis, and there was maybe 15 people there, and we're like, it was like so miserable out. It was like in the summer and so hot, and we set up all of our shit on the floor. And they played two songs, and then we played two songs, and then they played two songs. It was the most annoying thing, I think, for anyone who was at that show.
Wow.
It's like, what the fuck is this? But, I mean, like, we would just... I mean, that's the kind of thing, like, where... That's the kind of thing, like, where all this comes from. It's like this... Really? You want to talk about that?
Yeah.
It's super cool that, like, that you have this, that you're like, looking into it all. Cause I think like there was this moment of it is sort of like a, for me anyway, it's a strange crossing over between I heard about this band cause I've read a review of MRR over to like our band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that period of time like where it was just at the cusp of all that going away. The complete book your own fucking life was going away, and the I need your show in Pittsburgh, write me back, and getting 50 replies, like, you know, was coming in. So it was kind of like this weird time, like it was right on the cusp of like all this transition of being able to, with one click, be your own worldwide distributor of your own music. You know, it's like a really strange, empowering time, like where people were the last rows of people, you know, people needing help to empower themselves.
Yeah, and it's also that one click and you're done. And I didn't have a cell phone in college, and you know, you went to the show and you watched, like, I look at photos of shows back then and it's like everyone's watching the band.
We had a beeper.
Yeah, you had a beeper.
We had a beeper because like that's how we could, you know, we would tour, we'd pull over, we were close to town, and on a payphone somewhere, called the kid whose house we were playing at and get directions to their house or the club or whatever, you know, like, it's just like, we'd get on a dialer, like, you know, on the street and being on one of those modded dialers that
Braid would do.
I'm sure Eric told you about.
And I think it was Eric or I think that it was Bob or Chris Broach were mentioning about it too.
Oh yeah, that was the thing. Like, if there's one thing I could add to our whole conversation, it was like the dialer.
Yeah.
The dialer was this most amazing hack. It was like this Radio Shack thing for people who had like rotary phones. Back when people had phones in their house, landlines, kids, there was a rotary, you know, you had a rotary phone. And if you're trying to order, like, you know, push number 3 to access English, you couldn't do that. So you had to have the dialer, which would simulate the tone of you pushing 3. Some kid, I don't know who it was, I'd be really, really curious to figure out who invented this mod. They figured out you could buy some sort of chip and mod it into your Radio Shack dialer, and that would simulate the sound. It would raise the pitch of these things to where you could just pick up a payphone, and it would simulate the sound that the operator would hear of you getting quarters into the phone. So
that's so crazy.
On any payphone, like, you could just pick up and call and say, please insert $1.75. So you hit like *25, six lines or whatever. And
you would have enough money to call.
Yeah.
That's and so then crazy.
You continue to talk and it would prompt you to enter in more money. And then you put the dialer up to the phone receiver and enter in the code that sounded like quarters dropped into the phone, and it would work.
Was that in 2600, that magazine that's still around? Was it in that for the first time? Maybe not, but I remember kind of thinking that would be the place where it would live.
I don't know where it came about.
Yeah.
But it saved our ass. Over and over and over. So you pull into town, and you use a dialer to call the kid to figure out directions on how to get to where the show was. Hope to God he was home when you called, or she was when you called. Like, make your way into town. And
I think about that all the time. Like, how did we ever meet up with anybody? Hey, I'll meet you at the mall at 4. Everyone was there. Like, you just...
Yeah, you had to be there. There's no slacking. I'm on my way. You had to be there at 4.
Yeah, we said 4.
You had to be there at 4. You had to be there at 4, or you had to be the guy who wasn't there at 4.
And then you didn't get to go see Spider-Man or whatever.
And then all your friends thought you were lame because you weren't there at 4. Yeah, there's that responsibility. You had to be there at 4.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you were the guy who wasn't there at 4. And your friends, like, you know, there was social justice in not being there at 4. To get back to, like, your earlier question about, like, you know, people getting back together, it wasn't because, like, all that time wasn't that great. Because a lot of times, like, you drove all day to play for 4 people, including bar staff.
Yeah.
And, or you know, they'd sleep with their head on the toilet at the goat house. So, and that was not fun. But it was a unique experience. It's all rock and roll, man.
It's all rock and roll.